where we are. This is Mame Warren. Today is the 30th of April, 1996. I'm in Lexington, Virginia at the law school at Washington and Lee University with Uncas Mathenia. And you're a 7-year man, right?
Yes, but over a 10-year period.
Yeah.
Over a 9-year period, I guess.
Well, obviously, the thing I want to talk to you most about today is the law school. Mm. But I'd like to go back to your undergrad days, if you can think back that far. Because one of the things I found out in doing my little bit of research is that you were on the football team right after the big changeover.
Indeed I was, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
It's not a very famous chapter. Yeah, I can talk about that because that was one of the sort of highlights of my otherwise undistinguished career. As a student, one of the reasons I came to Washington Lee is because I thought that I would be able to play freshman football. I was never any good in high school, sort of a second string or just barely, I was not very good. But I thought, well, I could at least play freshman football there and that'd be fun. And it turned out that spring and summer, after I graduated from high school, it's when they dropped the whole schedule and all the stuff appeared in the papers about cheating scandals and one thing and another. And so when football was off and being young, I didn't think anymore about it one way or the other, I guess. The last thing I thought about was college much. But when we came here, they had what they call in those days a freshman camp down at Metro Bridge. Where all the incoming freshmen went for 3 days to be oriented toward the school. And in that meeting, the school was sort of bending over backwards, the officialdom, the administrators were bending over backwards, apologetic and saying, that this is no smirch on Washington Lee's character and this and that, and we'll get on with life here, and we promise you we'll have a football team, and we'll have one this fall. And so I salted that away, and two or three other guys who were there with me were scholarship students, and Washington Lee had honored those scholarships. These guys had come here to play football. Team had been dropped. Washington Lee said, we gave you a scholarship. You can come. I was not one of those. But some of my friends were. And so nothing happened the first two or three weeks, and nothing seemed to be happening in September. And so we started, our own form of student protest. Said, where's the football team you promised us we were going to have? And my recollection is we did things which were utterly brazen for the 1950s. We asked questions and told people that, you made these promises to us and things that students didn't normally do in those days. But the long and short of it is, I think that we were responsible for one of the greatest hires that Washington Lee ever had, because we, maybe I just inflate our position, but we kept making a little bit of noise about it. But they went out and the school hired Boyd Williams. Do you know Boyd?
No.
He is the single best teacher I ever had in college. He was an insurance man here in Lexington who had played for Syracuse University and then had played for the old New York Giants or maybe the Philadelphia Eagles, I don't remember which. And Boyd was prevailed upon to come up and put together a football team of the rattiest looking talent you ever saw. And he did it. And it was truly incredible, the kinds of things that Boyd Williams put up with. Here's a guy who was a real professional, putting up with a bunch of young men who the only ones who were any good didn't go out to football. And the only people who went out were a bunch of jerks like me. But he stuck with that the whole fall. And we went off, I remember the first game, and I think Frank Parsons was the sports writer or something He was just out of college, but he was the publicist for Washington. They didn't have many publicists in those days. But we went down to a place called Hargrave Military School, which is somewhere down the south side, and got beat. And then the next week, I think we played Stanton Military School or something and got beat again. And finally, I think the Hampton-Sydney JVs beat us. So we were god-awful. And as I said, the good guys, the people who were on real football scholarships, not many of them came out. Some of them switched to basketball, like Dom Flora, Frank Hoss, and those two I know came as football players, but didn't play football and played basketball. But some of the football players, like Fred Heine, who came on scholarship, did play, and some other ones didn't. And most of the sophomores, the people who were freshmen the year before, and juniors who were still left, most of them did not play that first season. A few of them did, but they all said we were rinky-dink, and we were pretty rinky-dink. But they didn't want to, they were mad at the university, I expect. But they didn't sort of play much. And so it was a chance for a bunch of people who didn't know what they were doing to be able to play football. And so we did that for the whole year. I really do think that of all the teachers I had in my career at Washington Lee and other places, that Boyd Williams was probably the best teacher I ever had.
And what did he teach?
He was just a football coach. And I mean just a football coach, pejoratively, but that's what he did. But he took people who weren't worth a damn, mate, and made us better than we were. You know, if you do something that was halfway acceptable, he made you feel like a king. If you missed something that was hard, he made you think you couldn't have gotten it anyway. And he was so important in my life, and he was so important in a lot of folks' lives, and he had such integrity. He still lives here, and he's not well, but he's retired and lives over on Barger Drive, I think. But he's had Crohn's disease, and Boyd's pretty elderly now. But I talked to him last year's last time I talked to him much. But Burdett's runs a Catholic student ministries or something here. They do a thing, ask me to do something last year called last lecture. If you had a chance to give a last lecture, what would you say? And what I said was you shouldn't give one. And then began talking about Boyd Williams. And so it's not far from my memory that he was so good with a bunch of, I don't want to talk about the rest of the guys, but third-rate football players. We didn't win any games, but we had a sense that we were somehow important. We had a sense that we somehow were doing the best we could. And you finally, he was gruff, mean, ugly, never cursed. But you wish he would curse you. Sometimes his silence was worse than his yelling. But he had such incredible integrity because he was obviously had a successful business. I can't believe anybody paid him very much to do this. And the next year, Washington Lee hired a quote real coach, Bill Chipley, put the football program on the road again. Well, Bill was good, but I think it was because Boyd had been there when nobody else was there. We all had our confidence in him. And this is what I mean about integrity. He saw that we were going to look to him more than we should if he's assistant coach. And he took to leaving and never coming to our games. He'd go scouting. That's what he said. I'm sure he was scouting. But I think one reason he was doing that was to not interfere with Bill Chipley's authority as chief coach. Because unconsciously or consciously, I think we weren't trying to subvert Chipley. But I think we tended to look to Boyd for leadership. And Boyd would just absent himself because he wasn't the guy in charge. And so whatever ego he had, he burned it away. And that was the kind of teacher he was. He just got out of the way and made you, he'd get inside, he'd stir up something inside of you that you didn't have and you didn't think you had, and he'd help you find it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really think that people have this thing about empathy all wrong. I don't think empathy is something you get from walking in somebody else's shoes. I think empathy is when somebody finds an opening in you that's restless and stirs it around, and whatever stirs up gives you something that you didn't know was there. And that's what Boyd did for me and for a lot of other folks. I mean, I can think of other people who are on that team who still feel the same way about Boyd. Fred Hine is one of them.
He sounds like an impressive person.
He is. He really is an impressive guy.
Now, you mentioned that you were stirring things up to get a coach and to get the team going. Who were you stirring up? Who were you talking to?
We were talking to other students, and then I think we were going to the, I recall going to the dean of students' office. And I have a recollection, but I don't know this for sure, that we may have had what was an early student protest. I think we never had the temerity to walk in Dr. Gaines' office, but I have a notion of standing out. I have some memory of standing out in the hall out there and thinking we were hotshots and speaking in a loud voice so people would hear us. And not that we were taking over Washington Hall, but we were. I have recollections of us asking for promises to be fulfilled. And I can't know whether we were asking that of ourselves or just yelling or what we were doing. But we did have to do a little scurrying around, is my recollection.
And now you mentioned the freshman camp. I wonder whether that wasn't an extraordinary freshman camp you went to, being the first freshman camp after such a big scandal.
Probably was. But the whole experience was so overwhelming for me that I wouldn't have any way to have any focus on that.
Tell me what you mean about it being overwhelming.
Well, I was a kid coming to college for the first time, and first time been sort of on my own where I could go to movies and do things I wanted to. And so I don't have any, all I have is my reactions of me walking into a big world, not how that world was reacting to me. There was a certain amount of apologetics going on at freshman camp that year. And there was a certain sensitivity, I think, to making sure that, I don't know if it was any more than usual, but that we were kind of aware that Washington Lee functioned with an honor system. And there was some conversation about those events. And the guy who was president of the student government turned out to be a friend of mine. And he was a very sensitive guy. And he may have, he probably went out of his way to sort of talk about the university and about the part of student government in the university and the part of the football program, because his name was Waddy Bowes, he's a doctor now, teaches at University of North Carolina Medical School, I think. He's very active in the pro-life movement. The last time I saw his name, he'd filed an amicus brief in the Casey decision in Pennsylvania recently. But Waddy was from Denver, Colorado, and he was a member of the same fraternity I belonged to, and that was a jock fraternity. So he was not an athlete himself, but They lived with all those guys, and none of our fraternity brothers had been kicked out that spring in the football scandal. But many of them were football players. Many of them were scholarship football players. And so I'm sure that they were grieving and they were smarting, and he probably was too at freshman camp. But I couldn't really, that's after the fact, that wasn't my assessment at the time. My assessment at the time was, you know, gee, I'm a young guy and all this world's here, and what do you do with it? So I don't know what was going on from the university's perspective. I do know that they quickly, they closed down the Beanery over there behind Washington Hall. There used to be a road that went through there. It went behind Reed Hall, and that slope where the library is now, there were a couple old buildings hanging off the side of that slope. And they were cinder block buildings, and one of them was some secret facility for telephone communications, and I don't know what that was all about. And they apparently had some documents stored in there during the Second World War out of Washington. But the other one was what they called the Beanery, which was a kind of a dining hall facility, basically for athletes. And everybody else ate in fraternity houses or else ate in restaurants. And the Beanery was open for a very few days that fall, and then my recollection is it just didn't open anymore after that. But I think they probably had the Beanery there for athletes and particularly football players to have training tables. And it might have been also for guys who didn't have the money to be in fraternities, those kind of things. But that the only sort of perceptible thing that we saw as they tried to open the Beanery, and it didn't stay open very long. But I don't know what was going on at the university. No gala homecomings, obviously, which had been apparently pretty notorious in the early 50s.
So there was no homecoming your freshman year?
No, there was no no homecoming game. I think Boyd spared us that shame. We didn't have anybody we could have played anyway, unless it was Sweetbriar. No, there was none that fall.
That's interesting. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that before.
I'm pretty sure it was not.
I suspect you're right. That's an era I'm just beginning to explore. Mm-hmm. So I was real excited when I realized that you arrived at that time. So you were a geology major.
Mm-hmm.
What inspired that?
I wanted to be a forester, and that was a that was the only thing I could do that would allow me to sort of spend a lot of time outside. Actually, I came to Washington Lee, and I don't quite know what all the combination was, but at the end of the year, I decided I wasn't going to come back. And I didn't, so I transferred. And I wanted to get on about being a forester. I had this kind of self-important notion of who I was. And much to the regret of some people who became very good friends of mine and some teachers who meant a lot to me, I transferred to NC State in Raleigh. And scandalized my folks, and ended up, it was a pretty stupid thing to do. I'd been there about a week and I realized I'd made a pretty bad mistake. And so I wrote Dean Gillum, because he tried seriously to talk me out of going, and a guy named Marshall Fishwick, who taught here, had been a friend of mine. And it's sort of been, in some ways, a mentor my freshman year. And he had tried to keep me in school and keep me from transferring, and I was too young to pay the attention to anybody's advice, and so I transferred. And then came back, and both those folks just welcomed me, let me back in school, first of all. and welcomed me with pretty open arms in February. And I was just looking for something. I realized that there was something I was learning at Washington Lee that I was not learning at NC State. And part of that was learn how to read and to write. The school was too big at NC State, so you just sort of had, you know. I wasn't smart enough to learn on my own. Well, you have to do a big school like this.
So why did Washington and Lee work so well for you?
What
was the method of teaching and learning that made it work for you?
There were a lot of people who welcomed questioning, and I was probably pretty arrogant in those days, but they, you know, they tolerate it. And some people would, I suspect, they went out of their way to bait me because they figured that I did have a little bit of sense, and they'd not bait me, but they would pay attention to me and give me a chance to argue with them. Because I had a real interest in politics, and I had a real interest in kind of really milking this experience, but I also wasn't brave enough to do it. So there were people out there who were just smart enough to push a little bit, and they do it in a way that I'd push back, and allowed me to kind of get over some of my provincialism and some of my insecurity. And I guess Dean Gillum was particularly helpful about that. Marshall Fishwick was he got a bad rap from a lot of people around here, but he was always there with a question to hook my mind for me.
Tell me more about that. What would he do? How was he in the classroom? Why did it work?
He was a show-off. But he was, but he also would engage. He wouldn't just shut you down if you asked a question. And he encouraged that kind of questioning. And he was fairly political, trotting out his kind of Yale half left wing politics, and I was a kind of a right winger. But he sort of welcomed argument, welcomed discussion. And then the guy who taught geology here, Marcella Stowe, was in many ways like Boyd Williams. He was too easy. He was never sufficiently demanding of his students, but he really did make learning an adventure. I mean, he would just tell a bunch of stories. And he, over there where John Elrod's office is now, I think it's John Elrod's office, the presidential suite, that used to be a two-story affair. It was called Washington Chapel. And down on the level, the real 200 level, he stood there and lectured. And basically lectured and told stories. And then you had the room full below him, and then there was a balcony. And geology was probably the easiest major or easiest course in the school or something, so you had all kinds of people in there. And that's one reason I got there, because a lot of football players were there, I think. But he really was, in spite of being too easy, he really did know how to tell a story that made sense and excited your imagination about kind of what happened to the earth that you live on. It's kind of made it come alive. And then some of the other courses that worked for me were just sheer hard work. I mean, they worked the hell out of you in the chemistry courses I took. And we had Saturday classes. And on one Saturday, we'd have a chemistry test. On the other Saturday, we'd have an English test. And then on the Saturday, when we didn't have an English test, we always had a theme turn in. So, you know, I spent most every Friday night in school in the library. Now, other people might have been clever and could get their courses arranged that they didn't have to put up with that, but I never could. And it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, because you'd spend a lot of time in the library, you know, kind of, and you get bored with studying, and you go read something interesting. But the chemistry department was good. Why I think I learned there is that they give you just about that much, you know, a pint's worth to learn, and it took you a long time to learn that pint's worth, but once you did it, you knew it, and you couldn't not learn it because you had to know it to get the next pint. So it was the incremental way in which the course was taught, the necessity to do things yourself in a lab, the kind of accountability principle that you had to be accountable every week. That was good.
How were you accountable?
You were accountable in terms of the lab work you did, and also in terms of the test you had to take that Saturday. I think I was probably one of Bill Watt. You know him? You met Bill Watt?
Not yet. He's on my list.
Yeah, well, I think I was one of his early students, probably his... he may have been a first-year teacher, and I doubt it, but he was very young. I was an early student of his, I remember that. And they had that whole chemistry department limbered up so that one guy would beat on you for a while, and then he'd disappear, and another guy would come beat on you for a while, and he'd disappear. And so you've had a 15-week semester, you had about six people whacking on you. And they all had little pieces of a workbook that they put together as a, you know, on these old mimeograph machines. And whoever taught that part of the course had written that part of the workbook because he knew where every jot and tittle was in there, and you damn well had to work. I mean, they were tough and very good. But they sort of ran the course in segments, I think. And everybody who taught, there obviously weren't six of them, there were probably three or four of them, but all those people who taught those segments were all rigorous, and they all, unfortunately, seemed to know you. You know, you think you're getting a new teacher, you can sneak by today, but that didn't work.
They chatted as they shifted.
Yeah, yeah.
From one to the next.
Then there's a guy who taught English, Ross Borden. And I used to make A's on his tests and C's on his paper requirements. And he said, you'll never make up. And so he gave me a C mid-semester or something. And I said, well, why don't I average out to a B? And he said, well, you'll never get a B from me unless you can write a better paper than you're writing. Unless you can write a B paper. I don't think I ever wrote a B paper. I think he gave me a B, I'm not sure. But he was rigorous, and he cared in the way in which he marked your papers, you could tell. He would just, with a perfectly symmetrical circle, would circle an error. And there was anything about it, but it was always in red ink. And, you know, it takes a lot of caring to make a symmetrical circle. I can't do that. So he kind of taught that way. He was a very, very tough teacher, but a good teacher.
Ross Borden.
Mm-hmm.
Was he here very long?
Yeah, well, I don't think so. I think he was here a few years. fewer than 10 years, and he went to school down in Florida because called New College, and it was a new college then. And I think he went down there because it was sort of new and experimental, and taught there for the rest of his career, I believe, because I've had law students who were students of his in his more mature years, or not more, but, you know, older years. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he stayed around here very long. And he didn't ever appear to be part of the Washington Lee establishment.
So who was the Washington Lee establishment then? Who were the big names?
I'm not sure. Fitz Flanoy. I don't know who the establishment was. And students had some perceptions, which were usually wrong. I assume that the intellectual establishment was probably Dean Laverne, Myers, who taught philosophy. Berman, I guess, taught economics. Wheeler taught political science. And then there was a kind of a shaggy dog establishment like Fitz Flournoy taught English.
Why shaggy dog?
Well, they'd been here for a long time. These guys like Laverne, Berman, Wheeler, all sort of came in from somewhere else, and Flournoy had been here forever and lived in Lexington and probably drank too much, although I just he would drink with his students, whether he drank too much or not. But a shaggy dog, because he sort of looked like a sheepdog, sort of, you know, kind of, well, like a sheepdog, looked sort of tacky, you know, and hair was going here and there. And he had all these old half-sewn-on patches on his coat, those kind of things. Those guys were really good teachers. There was a guy named Moffat. But my guess is that they were not among the intellectual elite. I don't know that. They were rigorous teachers, but they probably were not the image that some of the hotshots would like to have had for Washington Lee. Somebody like Tom Wolfe would know that better. There's a guy over here at Hamp Sidney, who's a writer. He's got a really good fix. I've heard him read here a couple times, and I can't think of his name now. He lives in Farmville. He was in that writing group with Tom Wolfe.
Oh, yes, he talked about him.
Tom Wolfe said he's the best writer you ever read.
Bill Hoffman?
Yeah, Bill Hoffman. Yeah. But Hoffman, I think, would have a fix on that old English department crowd that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wasn't in it. I just sort of took the courses occasionally. Mm-hmm. He wasn't around here. He may have been here once. So I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know who the intellectual elite was.
How about Dean Laverne? Did you have any interaction with him?
Yeah, I did. And it was a very positive interaction. Not much when I was in college, just sort of how are you kind of thing. And he used to come occasionally to our fraternity, and we would sort of have after dinner sessions occasionally, and we'd talk. But I never took any of his courses in college. I got to know him later when I was in law school and involved in student politics.
Well, shall we make that shift? We shift over to law school?
Yeah, just let me think one more thing. But my impression was that Dean Laverne always, unfortunately, knew who I was. But there was a student of his, and I got the impression that he probably, I always got the impression that Well, any encounter I had with him, I always felt like maybe I wasn't doing what I should be doing sometimes. He had that kind of stern eye. You know, so when you're a young person, some people do.
He had a stern eye.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But he was always very formal, and I didn't think he knew me, but he always did.
So what were these politics in law school?
Well, he wasn't in law school.
No, I know, but you're saying you knew him because you got involved in politics in law school.
Yeah, I was involved.
Were you involved in politics in undergrad, as an undergrad?
Yeah, but just sort of a backroom guy.
All right, well, let's get into law school. Let's get you into the front room.
Yeah, I was in law school. Came here in the mid-year, February, January, whenever it was. And I was finishing a big piece of work when I started law school. I wasn't going to stay here. I was just going to law school because it was one of the places I could get in mid-year. And I was finishing up a master's thesis from Columbia. Well, I finished it, and then I had a job that took me to Germany for the summer. And long and short of it is, the longer I stayed here, the more I liked it and the more friends I made. And see, I was worried about coming here to law school and falling back into a trap of juvenile behavior that I'd sometimes been into when I was in college. And sort of boredom about being in Lexington. Well, I didn't. I just developed a new set of friends and became a kind of place that was interesting to me. And it was a good place to study law. And in the process of that, in 1961 or something, kind of back up from when I got out of here. 63. Yeah, spring, I guess, of 1961, the university politics used to be controlled by fraternities in very definite kind of political machines. It was good old Dick Daley, take care of your brother politics. And whoever controlled the political slate got to make all the appointments to various other things. And that we thought that had some payoff. I think it might have been blue smoke and mirrors. But it was, the time I'd been involved in backroom politics was they had what they called the university party and independent party. There was a bunch of fraternities around Red Square and maybe a couple others who were the university party, and the rest of us were the independents. And so there was always that fight to see who you could hijack, to what fraternity you could make promises to get them to join your party so that you'd win all the student elections that year. So while I was, the first two or three years I was in school, our crowd was in the ascendancy, as I recall. Because my fraternity was president student body when I was a first year, when I was a freshman in college, was in my fraternity, was an independent. Next year, I don't know who that was. Somebody else, I think. I think the other guys won. And then my senior year, another fraternity brother of mine was student body president. So we apparently had controlled the clique for a couple of years anyhow. And when I was in law school, that system was still extant, but there was a larger block of independent students, and the independent party had not nominated anybody for student body president because there was a guy who was had been a real student leader, kind of a powerful politician, who was nominated by the university party, which was basically the Red Square SAE crowd, the sort of southern guys. And so nobody was going to run against him. And I was sitting around the law school one night, just sort of half bored, and said, well, I'll just run against him. And so I remember you had to be nominated through some process at the student body constitution, and I went down, because the parties had sort of weren't going to run anybody against him, because I think that was the deal. They figured they didn't run anybody against him, they couldn't get hammered too badly the rest of the ticket. But anyway, I ran, and I got the non-fraternity students supporting me, and the kind of people who were more on the margin of the school, and got elected, much to my surprise, and it really was to my surprise. But in the process, after that thing, the next year, things started to bubble around here. It was 61, and the Freedom Rides had started, and the Walgreens sit-ins had started, and Martin Luther King had the bus boycott in Montgomery. I think he had been stabbed in 59, hadn't he?
Somewhere in there.
Well, he was recovering, and the SCLC was forming, and this was before the real Southern strategy started, but there was some thought that something was going to go on in Danville, and in fact did later. Virginia was in the midst of massive resistance. Prince Edward had closed the schools, I think. Anyway, the University Christian Federation, which was then called the Christian Council, had invited Martin Luther King to speak at Washington in the fall. And the trustees had rescinded the invitation. And we got a hold of it on the student council, what the executive committee, and wrote all the board trustees, telling them what an awful thing that was, and they shouldn't do that, and interfere with that academic freedom, and this and that, and the other thing. And provoked a sort of a 15-minute crisis. And I worked with Dr. Laburn during that time. I mean, he was sort of an advisor of mine.
And where was he on the issue?
He thought it was a travesty. I think he had already been fired by the board as dean. I know he was no longer dean, and I think he was too threatening to the old-time establishment of Washington Lee. I think he had notions of the student wisdom was that he had notions of turning this place into a real university, and it was just too hot for the board trustees. Whether that's reality or not, I don't know. But he was teaching. He was no longer dean. But his office was in the basement of the old Laburn Library, which is now the Commerce School. And I remember spending a lot of time sitting there talking to him in his office, and we were trying to garner support and I think the way we did what we did, the way we got our kind of sense about ourselves is we wrote the trustees a letter telling them that was a dumb thing to do and probably used all the useful imagery you can think of. But actually it was a pretty polite letter. And I was president of the student body and wrote that letter, and I got letters, which John Jacobs has some of them downstairs, I think. I think I have some of them at home, but I can't find them. But I remember Lewis Powell's on the board of trustees, Rocky Holt, who was former governor of West Virginia, a guy named Lanier from Texas, and a lot of people who were very close to the Byrd organization. If they were in the organization, I don't know. But they were the kind of the most of them were polite letters. Some of them were like, little boy, y'all ought to be, it's none of your affair, stuff like that.
some of them were, you know, thank you very much for your letter kind of thing, and some were saying, you know, you shouldn't be a student at Washington Lee if you write a letter like that, or, you know, it was a thing you'd expect from pretty conservative men who didn't appreciate what was happening in the country. And I'm not sure I did either, but it was part of being a student, I think. And at that time, there's a guy, Lou Hodges, you probably know. Mm-hmm. Lou Hodges had been here about a year, I think, teaching, and he was intimately involved in that whole affair as an advisor to the Christian Council or whoever. I think, I don't know who all was on the group that invited, but a lot of people who'd been supporters of mine politically were on the group. A guy named Bill Lowry, who's a priest in the Episcopal Church, I think, in Baltimore now. A guy who used to be here as an Episcopal rector, John Fletcher, who's now teaches at the University of Virginia Ethics Graduate School, teaches with Jim Childress.
I need to turn the tape over.
Okay.